Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the regular meeting of the Multnomah County Board of Commissioners. Commissioner Shannon Singleton is excused. Audience members, I want to start by asking you to please silence your electronic devices. I would also like to remind you that in addition to the audience in this room, we have people watching and listening online. So please consider your language in comments and testimony today. Today's meeting is a hybrid board meeting. Some presenters and guests will appear in person and some will appear virtually. For those presenting virtually, please mute your mic when not speaking. When presenting, make sure to unmute your mic and turn on your camera. For those joining us in person to provide public testimony or present, please turn your mic on when you begin speaking and off when you've completed your remarks. For all presenters, please state your name for the record before speaking or responding to questions. So we do have a request by a commissioner to move our C1 off the consent calendar. So we will be moving that off of the consent calendar. Can I have a motion on consent, the consent calendar containing items C2 through C5?
Second.
Okay, Commissioner Jones-Dixon moves. Commissioner Brim Edwards seconds. Approval of the consent calendar.
Commissioner Moyer?
Aye.
Commissioner Brim Edwards?
Aye.
Commissioner Jones-Dixon?
Aye.
Chair Vega Peterson?
Aye. The consent calendar is approved.
Opportunity for public comment on non-agenda matters. This is a time for the board to hear public testimony, not for board deliberation. When it is your turn to speak, I'll call your name and unmute you or call you to the presenter's table. I'll set a timer for 3 minutes when you begin speaking and announce when your time is up, at which point please wrap up your sentence. Chair, we received five verbal testimonies today. I'll call four folks at a time. Injured and pissed off, Chris Lowe, Lightning, and Charles Johnson.
Good morning.
Good morning. BM. There's good BM and there's bad BM. BM stands for bowel movement. I've been at a care facility and there's two papers here. The good BM is everybody ought to know it if they're living, that is. I'm talking about bowel movement. And bad BM is, and super bad BM is injuring a blind person and injuring a service animal twice severely, to where he limped 30 days each time, and the Multnomah County Board of Commissioners, which is in charge of the animal control, did nothing. And animal control did nothing, and even the court did nothing. I had a valid restraining order during the sixth dog attack and went to court in Multnomah County Court, the old building, and they dismissed the case saying that she really didn't mean it. Well, I didn't bother with the seventh, filling out another restraining order. And of course, there was a seventh dog attack, and I got mistreated too at the hospital. Unless you call it medical treatment, standing up a person with two vertebrae in their spinal cord that had been fractured, standing them up for 3 days, and all I could do was throw up. And even in the care facility, the state care facility that I was moved from OHSU to Avonmere Care in Beaverton, which is state-owned. And while there the first month, they couldn't even lift me out of bed because of the spinal cord injuries that they had inflicted on me. I mean, the swelling and with the hip. They had to keep it straight. It took three people to even clean me up. I'm saying that I didn't even have bowel movements unless it was just laying in bed. They couldn't lift me up to even put me on a bedpan. There was something else. Well, there's a 1,000-plus bill here. The facility that I've been at has apparently been sold to somebody. I don't know who bought it or whatever, but you know, that can be found out. I have memory problems.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Lightning. I represent Lightning Superhumanity X1, X7, X3333. Now, I noticed that you had a commissioner which they have their special privileges and they're above the community members. Cut that, please. Okay. They were able to pull a consent agenda item. I've asked numerous times to do that as the public. And again, I know I'm not special like the commissioners or the chair and have those special privileges that you do. But I'm curious on why you don't allow a public member to do that. And I'd like you to put that on record for the public, because I'd like to have C4 pulled on the Oregon State Marine Board, the grant that went to Multnomah with a Klan History County River Patrol. And again, I was able to stop $470,000 on that grant through some communication directly to them by some high-level developers and people that fund numerous organizations and nonprofits through this city. Now, again, that grant that they receive is for equipment purposes, and I put Oregon State Marine Board on notice when you provide the equipment to Multnomah with the Klan History County River Patrol that their illegal activities that they performed on my marina, Columbia River Marina, which was witnessed by Travis Goldberg, that has a duty to intervene, if anybody knows him, as the police chief now at Gresham, which he was standing there witnessing them trying to set me up, having their tactical people there, and walking back and pulling their guns on me. He's standing right there. He will not deny that, because he is my witness now. And as federal judge Michael Simon will say to Travis Goldberg, you have a duty to intervene. You have a duty to speak truthfully, and you will. You will do that. And Mr. Helfike down in Salem was also a river patrol. He will do the same as my witness. I can assure you of that. Now, on this grant again, I would like to have the total amount not paid. I would like to have the federal government come in right now and just stop the grant. And we will take them in court and just battle them out for the next 3 to 5 years. And the reality here is that they conduct themselves illegally on my property.
Thank you.
And they are not, even to me, a legitimate law enforcement entity.
Thank you, Lightning.
And they should not receive any grant money.
Okay.
And for you to do that, you're pushing forward.
Happy Pride, or almost Happy Pride. When we are able to pay attention to the online hoopla for all this, we go and we see there's a public notice that you're having this board meeting. And then more good news, a quorum of you all might intersect at the Albina Library, but that means a quorum of you all are not planning to intersect at the Pride Parade, even when the lesbian, gay, trans, two-spirit community is under attack by the federal government. We can't get a quorum of y'all to come to the main Pride event Sunday morning. Maybe it'll happen. Maybe you're not absolutely required. It could happen that three of you show up. It'll just be coincidental. It won't be a quorum. On the consent agenda, aside from what was just discussed, across the river, probably individual citizens have the right and the power to have items removed from the consent agenda. That was the practice from like 1899 up until hopefully now, or at least up until January 1st. So I do think that as you consider responsiveness to your constituents, it might not be a tragic rule change if consent agenda items could also be pulled by members of the public. The thing that's on my mind a lot, though, is Street Roots, which y'all have opportunity to read, and inside and on the cover. Inside and on the cover of Street Roots, super journalist Jeremiah Hayden. I don't think he was in Washington, D.C. to watch the Supreme Court give the finger to American women and tell them they have no body, the state can take away their bodily autonomy. But I do believe he was there for the Grants Pass revision of the Boise case. And of course, he's found $9 million, but oops, it's actually money that's already been spent because of settlements, you know, settlements that don't specifically admit recklessness or carelessness or excessive intentional violence. $9 million of city of Portland tax money is moving through individual person's economy. So it's not a big loss for the area, but it's indicative of a problem of people having so much suffering and abuse in their life that the risk management office in the city says, holy crap, we better give these people a hunk of cash. And that is most intersectional for you in that you are the primary conveners and I think appointees for the LPSC, the Local Public Safety Coordinating Council. And I don't know, somebody's bad news is somebody else's good news. So good news for WinCo, bad news for Fred Meyer. At least with the closure of the Gateway Fred Meyer, we won't have a food desert. People can still go to WinCo. But with the I don't believe Target, when they closed the stores, had a serious out-of-bounds theft problem. I do believe it's a possibility at Gateway, even with this enhanced security measures. So the number one thing about public safety is keeping individuals safe. But we also need economic stability. So I hope the LPSC will talk about safe, viable environments, not just for individuals, but for business to continue throughout this county. Thank you.
Checking again for Chris Lowe and August Waldron.
I hope that was awesome Reed College staffer, Chris Lowe, labor activist and super intellectual, but alas, we won't get to hear from him.
I'm sure that is all the public testimony today.
All right, thank you. Let's move on to R1. But before we do that, can I have a motion to postpone item C1 indefinitely?
So moved.
Can I have a second?
Second.
All right, thank you. And this is, again, just the request to move that item off the consent agenda indefinitely means that we're going to be finding a date. We don't have a date certain at this point, so we will work on that and we will bring it back shortly before the board. All right, any further discussion on that?
Yeah, just I wanted to note that it doesn't have anything to, those are a series of appointments. It doesn't have anything to do with the actual individuals being appointed. It's just we don't have complete information packets, so it's just moving into a future date. But again, I don't want anybody to be concerned that there's a concern about any of the appointees.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, thank you for that clarity.
Thank you. Marina, can we have a roll call vote?
Commissioner Moyer?
Aye.
Commissioner Brim Edwards?
Aye.
Commissioner Jones-Dixon?
Aye.
Chair Vega Peterson?
Aye. The motion to postpone indefinitely is approved.
R1, first reading of ordinance amending Multnomah County Code Chapter 5 to implement ranked choice voting in county candidate elections.
Second. All right. We have Commissioner Jones-Dixon moving, Commissioner Brim Edwards seconds, approval of R1. Good morning. So I just wanted to start off by thanking again our incredible elections team. I'm so glad that we have the director, Tim Scott, here. You all did an excellent job on the rollout of ranked choice voting last November for Portland's historic election. It was a new way of voting. It was a new form of government, a lot of new things happening. Tim and Leah, you have seen to every detail along with a really outstanding team. I just really want to appreciate that. So now we are moving to ranked choice voting for the county for 2026. And I know that you all continue to do whatever it takes to make sure that we have a safe, secure, and transparent election process. So with that, I will turn it over to you. Thank you.
Thank you, and good morning, Chair Vega Peterson and members of the board. My name is Tim Scott. I'm the Director of Elections, and I'm here with
Leah Benson, Ranked Choice Voting Project Manager.
And we're here today to present a proposed ordinance to amend Chapter 5 of the Multnomah County Code for the implementation of ranked choice voting for Multnomah County candidate contests. Next slide. First, I'll share a brief background of why we are bringing this proposed ordinance to the board. In November 2022, Multnomah County voters approved a measure to require the use of ranked choice voting in for all county candidate contests no later than the 2026 general election. At the same time, Portland voters also approved a measure to require the use of ranked choice voting for City of Portland candidate contests. In November 2024, the Elections Division successfully administered the first ranked choice voting contest for City of Portland, and we are now in the process of preparing for the implementation of RCV for county contests in November 26. Next slide. Our first step in preparation for administering the county's first RCV candidate contest is to update county code to define the tabulation process, including voter intent guidelines and other information that defines how ranked choice voting elections are administered for county contests. Once the code is updated, we will move on to planning for voter education, fine-tuning RCV ballot processing procedures, and building the election and results reports to align with county code. Next slide. In the drafting of this proposed ordinance, public engagement came from two key places. First, the Multnomah County Charter Review Committee. The committee performed public engagement before recommending the use of instant runoff voting for Multnomah County voters, who approved the measure with 69% of the vote. The public feedback was incorporated into the drafting of the charter amendment and is reflected in the proposed ordinance. Second is our RCV voter experience research. In November 2024, the Elections Division administered the county's first RCV elections for the City of Portland candidate contest. Post-election polling by the Portland City Auditor and focus groups convened by the Elections Division showed that 91% of voters reported understanding how to fill out their ballots, and the voters felt that educational materials provided by the county and city were sufficient. This research did not point to any major changes that voters would like to see in future RCV elections. Next slide. The proposed ordinance was drafted with two main goals in mind. First, alignment with Multnomah County Home Rule Charter. The proposed ordinance reflects the language in the county charter and would update the county code to accurately describe the use of ranked choice voting to elect Multnomah County officials. Second, consistency with the City of Portland ranked choice voting election code. With the adoption of the ordinance, the county's RCV code would mirror the city's RCV code in key ways, which we will outline in further slides. Next slide. There are two main forms of ranked choice voting: single winner ranked choice voting, also known as instant runoff voting, and multi-winner ranked choice voting, also known as single transferable vote or proportional ranked choice voting. As Multnomah County does not have any multi-member districts, Multnomah County Home Rule Charter stipulates that all elective county officers will be elected at the general election using instant runoff ranked choice voting. The proposed ordinance outlines the process by which votes are tallied and a candidate is elected using instant runoff voting as follows. A candidate must reach a threshold of 50% plus one to be elected. Tabulation begins by first looking only at voters' highest ranked choices. If a candidate at that point has over 50% of the vote, they are elected. If not, the candidate with the fewest votes is defeated and their votes are transferred to the next highest candidate choices on those ballots. This process of defeating candidates and transferring votes continues until a candidate reaches the 50% plus one. This is the same process that is used for the mayor and auditor of the city of Portland. And now I'll hand things over to Leah for more details of the code.
Thank you. Leah Benson, Ranked Choice Voting Project Manager again. Next slide, please. As Tim stated, beyond alignment with county charter, our other key goal in the drafting of this ordinance was consistency between the city and county election codes. Aligning the city and county codes will allow for consistent voter education between the city and county, a consistent experience of marking a ballot for Portland and Multnomah County contests, consistent results reporting formats, and additionally aligns all back-end election administration processes for city and county contests, ensuring that RCV elections are carried out in an efficient manner. With the adoption of this ordinance, the county's RCV code would mirror the city's RCV code in the following ways. First, the same use of single winner ranked choice voting as Tim just outlined. Second, the required certification of write-in candidates. With this update, candidates could only be elected through the write-in process if they are certified as write-in candidates prior to the date of election. This is a common practice used by many jurisdictions who use ranked choice voting, and one that was adopted by the City of Portland in 2024 to provide efficiency in the tabulation of write-in candidates for ranked choice voting contests. Third, we would be consistent with the City of Portland by allowing voters to rank up to 6 candidates on their ballots so that the ballot design would be the same between city and candidate contests. And finally, we would provide the same automatic voter intent interpretation for skipped rankings, repeat rankings, and overvotes. Next slide, please. So this is a slide that comes directly from voter education presentations that we did last fall. There's a little error on that first image there, but showing the skipped rankings, overvotes, and repeat rankings. By having the same interpretations through county code and city code, we can ensure that the instructions are the same on the ballot and that the voter education is the same in the community, regardless of if we're talking about City of Portland contests or Multnomah County candidate contests with ranked choice voting. Next slide, please. In addition to these pieces that allow for consistency with the City of Portland Elections Code, the Elections Division also examined findings in the 2024 RCV implementation report that we put together and researched best practices from other jurisdictions who administer RCV elections. And we have included 2 additional elements in the proposed ordinance that aim to improve the voter experience and the efficiency of RCV election administration. First, a minimum of 2 filed candidates for RCV contests. The proposed ordinance defines ranked choice voting as an election method that is used when there are at least 2 filed candidates. The reasoning for this is that it is not possible to rank candidates in relation to each other when there is only 1 candidate. Hence, it is common practice to set a minimum number of candidates needed for RCV to be used. For an example of what this would look like in practice, in the November 2024 RCV contest for Portland Auditor, there was only 1 filed candidate. Less than 2% of voters used 2 ranks, with the second rank being used for a write-in candidate. And the filed candidate was elected after 1 round of counting with nearly 99% of the vote. If first past the post voting had been used, the same results presentation would have been achieved, but the voting and results reporting process would have been much more efficient and simple for voters. The second efficiency addition that we're looking into is batch elimination, which I'll go into in more depth on the next slide, please. Batch elimination allows for the simultaneous defeat of multiple candidates whose vote totals combined is less than the total vote total of any other candidate, which makes their election impossible since there is no way for them to ever gain enough votes to move forward in tabulation. Batch elimination is a common practice for jurisdictions across the United States who administer single winner ranked choice voting elections, because it both simplifies the results displays for voters and produces several efficiencies in key election administration's processes, such as hand recounts. Important to note here, though it does create efficiencies, it does not change the voting experience at all in filling out a ballot, and crucially, it does not change the final results of an election. Let's look at a couple examples of what this is in practice. Next slide, please. First, this is the final results report from the May 2021 mayoral primary contest in New York City, where batch elimination is used for ranked choice voting contests. As you look at the report, you'll see that batch elimination occurred in rounds 4 and round 6 of tabulation. Let's specifically look at round 4 in a little bit more detail. Here we'll see Paperboy Love Prince, everyone's favorite candidate name, Aaron S. Foldenauer, Art Chang, and Joycelyn Taylor were all eliminated as a block. If we look to the column for round 3, we can see why. The total of the votes for all 4 of those candidates was less than the next highest candidate, Sean Donovan, who had 23,314 votes. Going a little deeper even, of the 4 candidates who were eliminated, Aaron S. Foldenauer had the greatest share of votes at 7,819. As a reminder, candidates are eliminated by having the fewest votes, which means that eliminations will always come from the bottom of the candidate list, from those with the fewest votes. So even if Joycelyn Taylor, Paperboy Love Prince, and Art Chang had all been eliminated one by one, there is still no way for Aaron S. Foldenauer to gain enough votes to surpass Sean Donovan and not be defeated. And so batch elimination simplified the results by condensing the rounds, but did not have a result have any effect on the final outcome. Regardless of if batch elimination or one-by-one elimination had been used, Eric Adams still would have won with the exact same number of votes. Next slide, please. I want to look at one other example, one that's a little bit closer to home. And this is showing what it would have looked like if we had applied batched elimination to the Portland mayor contest in November of 2024. As you can kind of see in the background, there is a very large report there that shows 20 rounds of counting, which is how many rounds of tabulation it took to elect the mayor in November of 2024. If batch elimination had been used, the same candidate would have been elected with the exact same amount of votes, but it would have only taken 7 rounds of tabulation. So in summary, batch elimination is a commonly used tabulation method for single winner ranked choice voting that does not change the final outcome of a contest, but does drastically simplify results presentations and provide efficiencies in back-end processes. Tim, I'd like to hand it over to you now.
And she's handing it over to me to just say thank you for your time. And if there's any questions, we would be happy to answer them.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate this. And I know you've had briefings with several members of the board. We do have somebody signed up for public testimony. So I would just ask if you guys wanted to just take a seat right behind you, and then we'll bring you back up for questions.
Charles Johnson.
I love it. I'm Bridge Crane Charles Simca Johnson, and besides loving ranked choice voting and some of the results we've got, we can all we can do is cross our fingers and hope that somehow in our first ranked choice ballot, we'll have a stunning, people-loving, Islamist, communist, anti-Semite who will come out on top. I say that very sarcastically because I'm happy with the outcomes in New York City with their ranked choice voting and the success of the Democratic Socialists of America there. We'll see what happens in the general election. And will our situation be different? I guess maybe one of you will ask Mr. Scott to clarify this. This means there'll be no primary for county offices, I believe. I knew somebody would be able to communicate with me in some way about a lightening of the as far as not as many slots or positions having to be on the May 2026 primary ballot. I'm sure there'll still be many things that we can use our voting rights on. But thanks, y'all, for moving this forward and having the excellent slide 11 and explanation of batch elimination and a chance for, like, I don't really remember those 10 or 13 cycles of tabulation could have been eliminated to give us Keith Wilson as mayor and not Renee Gonzalez. Thank you.
Thank you so much. All right. I would invite Leah and Tim back up, and then we will go to the board with any questions. I will start with Commissioner Moyer.
Yeah, thank you for all of this work. I was quite impressed with the implementation of the City of Portland ranked choice voting. As far as commissioners still being a single candidate, do you anticipate any confusion or needing to educate voters that they're not voting for multiple candidates in the commission seats versus the city version? And have you thought about how you will clarify that?
Thank you, Commissioner Moyer. You know, thank you for the call out. We will be planning our voter education campaign for the portions of Multnomah County that are not in the city of Portland through the lens of what does this group of people need to know that that maybe city of Portland residents gotta look at, as well as now we're also educating city of Portland voters who haven't voted on county commissioners yet. So I appreciate the call out. That's certainly something we'll be putting into our lens.
All right, thank you. Commissioner Brim Edwards.
Good morning. Thank you for the presentation and for bringing this forward. It seems pretty straightforward, and I'm glad to see that we're capitalizing on the sort of learnings from City of Portland and their most recent election. I had just two sort of follow-up questions. The certification of the write-in candidates, I was looking in the ordinance of, like, how do you, like, is that a barrier to, because I think traditionally people have, like, oh, you can just, you know, run a write-in campaign. But the certification, it looks like from the ordinance that it's just 7 days beforehand, they must say that they will serve if elected, but that they also meet the necessary qualifications. I'm assuming that's just like the general qualifications for the office. So it's pretty straightforward. It's just same as any other candidate, but you just have to file something 7 days before. Is there a filing fee or?
There's no filing fee for write-in candidates. So there's only, other than the city of Portland, which just adopted this for the 2024 election, there's only two candidate contests in Oregon where certification of write-ins are required. One is the Soil and Water Conservation District directors, and they file with the Department of Agriculture. And the other is precinct committee people. So it's not an incredibly common process in Oregon. However, it is pretty common in ranked choice voting jurisdictions around the country. I think we could have done a better job of educating potential candidates about what it would take to file as a write-in candidate for the city of Portland. I'd like to see our education materials modified to include more details about what that would take. But essentially it is filing a form at least 7 days before the election and meeting the qualifications.
Thanks. And then there's not a big window between filing day and the voter's pamphlet deadline, but say if somebody missed the filing deadline but then decided to run as a write-in, would they have the opportunity to be in the voter's pamphlet?
I mean, the intent of the certified write-in process is, and the write-in process in general, as I've always understood it in elections for a long time, is that people who miss the filing deadline have the opportunity to run as a write-in candidate. With only a few days between the candidate filing deadline, it seems like it may not be possible for someone to file a candidate statement.
But they could.
I would have to check okay. state law, but the situation has not come up yet.
So then the other question, this is more about sort of the continuing education. It's the numbers were interesting about how people, that's the high rate of responses of people feeling that they were prepared to vote and knew what to do in the city of Portland. One of the places where I got a lot of questions, and it kind of surprised me because of the number of candidates, but people were like, what if I don't have six candidates? Like, do I have to fill in all six? And I think this will be more of a question likely potentially in the county races, just because if you just look historically, there's been just fewer candidates. And I think there are a lot of reasons why there were so many candidates. But I'm curious, is that something that you could wrap into your overall education campaign? Because it was the most common, like, I found four, but I can't find it, which I'm like, there's 20 of them. Like, why can't you find six? But that was a question of whether people actually had to fill that all out.
Absolutely. Voters do not have to fill in ovals for all six ranks. It's something we stressed in the education for the city of Portland, but we will also redouble our efforts to make sure people are aware of that going forward. And if, to address the other part of your question, if there are not six candidates that file, there will be the number of candidates that file plus one for a write-in. So the grid shrinks a bit if there are not six filed candidates.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Jensen.
Yeah, great. Thank you. Thank you, Director Scott and Leah for the presentation. As mentioned before, our office will be tracking just the voter education out in East Multnomah County. And I know Commissioner Singleton isn't here, but just a huge thank you for asking and the board for approval for the additional investment as far as the voter education out in East Multnomah County. Spot on. Thank you.
Of course. Thank you.
Thank you all so much. I know that all the election geeks across the country have been looking at ranked choice voting and how we've been doing it so closely. I mean, it's so interesting to me how this works, but it is more complex. It is different than before. So I appreciate the ongoing efforts to educate the public, to make sure that we are able to, meet the public's expectations with this. Again, having just a few years to do this between when charter reform passed at the city and then in 2024 actually implementing it was a huge, huge achievement. And just you all did outstanding work. I'm glad that the partnership and education with the city is going to continue to happen as we move into this this next election cycle, because the city of Portland also has half-term folks that are going to be up for some of their districts as well. So it will be now a dual, kind of a dual system. And I appreciate Commissioner Moyer's question on how are we going to differentiate and educate, in terms of you're voting for multiple for a city council, but only one for county. So lots of good work to do. But these changes that we are going to be making today are going to help us make sure that we have those elections, the strong, safe, secure elections that we need. So thank you. Marina, can we have a roll call vote?
Commissioner Moyer?
Aye.
Commissioner Brim Edwards?
Aye.
Commissioner Jones Dixon?
Yes.
Chair Vega Peterson?
Aye. The first reading is approved, and the second reading is scheduled for July 24th, 2025.
R2, resolution approving the FAC 1 project plan for construction for the Juvenile Justice Complex lobby renovation.
May I have a motion?
So moved.
Second.
Commissioner Brim Edwards, Commissioner Jones Dixon moves. Commissioner Brim Edwards seconds. Approval of R2. Right. And we have our teams from DCA and DCJ. Welcome. Good morning.
Morning.
Great. And is Christina starting us off?
Yes, good morning, Chair and Commissioners. I am Christina Pomerenke, the Facilities and Property Management Project Delivery Program Manager with the Department of County Assets. I am here with the Construction Project Manager, Martin Favel, and DCJ Senior Manager, Sylvia Gomez. Next slide, please. We are here today seeking board approval for the construction of the Juvenile Justice Complex Lobby Renovation Project. We will review the project background and scope, current and improved site layouts, as well as the project budget and schedule. Next slide, please. For reference, the Juvenile Justice Complex is located on 68th Avenue, just off of I-84, and houses various programs to include the juvenile courts, juvenile detention, and supporting programs such as the Department of County Justice or Community Justice, excuse me. Next slide, please. While Martin will go more in depth with the project, I wanted to highlight the goals and objectives, including providing more safety and security to the public employees within the building, while also improving the overall experience while having to be at the juvenile justice complex. And now I will turn it over to Sylvia Gomez to provide background information for the project.
Good morning, Chair and Commissioners. My name is Sylvia Gomez. I am a senior manager, Department of Community Justice with the Juvenile Services Division. I'm going to give you a, next slide too. I'm going to give you a brief history of how this project got started. In 2022, JSD requested a workplace security and vulnerability assessment to improve upon the security that we currently have. In 2023, we got those recommendations and we took it upon ourselves to envision a space where it was much more welcoming that we currently have, as well as implementing those recommendations that were given to us. We incorporated those recommendations and we formed a redesign committee. And that redesign committee also used trauma-informed design in its color palette and also in the design itself. And that design was to be much more welcoming to youth, families, our staff, our partners, and as well as the general public. In 2024, the board approved a one-time funding for the project. And then in 2025, the board approved additional funding to complete the project. And we look forward to having that space. I'm going to pass it to Martin, who is going to provide more of the project scope.
Good morning, Chair and Commissioners. My name is Martin Favel, he, him, longtime listener, first time caller. I'm a construction project manager for this project. In these slides, I'll be providing more information on the scope, schedule, and budget. Next slide, please. Oh, actually, keep it here. Juvenile Justice Complex Lobby Renovation Project Plan will have a focus on security upgrades, including relocating the security desk, reconfiguring the security sequence with the installation of entry-exit turnstiles and security barrier glass panels, relocating the customer service desk, and the installation of updated security equipment, such as new cameras and video monitoring system, ballistic protection, an auto lockout feature for the entry doors, and various equipment updates. And really, it's being modeled after the central courthouse entryway and the successes they've had with that security sequence. This project will also be an opportunity to modernize the outdated lobby. Modernization upgrades will include updated finishes and casework, a newly furnished lounge in the lobby center, a privacy meeting booth, and a comprehensive updated wayfinding system. Next slide. On the left, you can see the exterior entrance to the juvenile justice complex. The picture on the right shows the current conditions of the juvenile justice complex interior lobby space as you walk in the front. Take note of the centralized location of the customer service desk and the security station. Without a wall backdrop, the staff is currently exposed to potential threats both from the second floor above and from behind. Next slide. Here's a bird's eye view from our construction plans showing the same conditions. There are two desks located at the center of the lobby. I know it's kind of hard to tell with the dotted lines there. but the security desk is located on the right and faces the front entrance, while you see the customer service desk on the left. Along with exposing staff to potential threats, this workstation setup also has day-to-day operational risks for the security team, who have very little control over who's coming in and out of the building, especially during busy times of the day. Next slide. Here you'll see a rendering of the same space showing the new security sequence that'll be installed. The security station will now be located in the room labeled MCSO at the top of your screen there, with their scanner and X-ray equipment located just south of the space. This is a new enclosed space with a window opening that'll allow security officers to look over the lobby and communicate with its users. The room can be secured during non-operational hours with a lockable coiling door and badged entry. Ballistic rated paneling installed in the wall below the open window will provide the security officers an area to duck and cover in an active threat situation. And the security station will also have new casework finishes and new video station, as previously mentioned. You can also see the improved traffic flow as indicated by the arrows on the screen. At the building entrance on the right, you can see we are redirecting traffic flow at the entry doors with a dedicated entry and exit only pathway. As you follow the yellow arrow, users will enter the lobby and proceed to the right to go to the new security sequence. Staff can follow a separate traffic flow indicated by the green arrow. This will take staff to a staff-only entry turnstile with a badge reader. And lastly, the blue arrow leads users to the exit, where there are three exit-only turnstiles. And then centered in the lobby there will be the new waiting area, which will be bordered by security glass panels. And it's not on screen now, but the new reception desk will be relocated to the hallway through the double doors at the top of the screen there. Next slide. All right, so here's our fancier rendering of the completed lobby space. The new trauma-informed paint color scheme will highlight program entryways with a blue-green accent while softening some of the larger spaces with a light gray accent. The new furniture in the waiting area will create a welcoming space for users to congregate with some family-friendly fixtures such as animal-themed chairs. Kind of hard to see in the picture, but little light green ones there in the center. Updated wayfinding system will install more comprehensive signage and will highlight separate program entryways with painted accents. And in the bottom left corner, you'll see a rendering of the new customer service desk location. This space will include two new workstations along with all new furniture and casework. Next slide. Here's a high-level look at the project budget. Total project cost is estimated at $2.5 million, with construction just under $1.5 million. Purchasing of furniture and equipment is estimated at $335,000, with design, permitting, and PM fees at about $384,000. And lastly, miscellaneous fees and contingency will cover about $336,000. Next slide. And an overview of the schedule here. Programming and design started in summer of 2023 and carried into 2025. Procurement and permitting took place from January through June of this year, 2025. And we plan to start construction with approval from the board in August and hope to complete the project by the end of the calendar year. Next slide. With that, the project team is seeking board adoption of a resolution approving the FAC 1 project plan for construction for the Juvenile Justice Complex lobby renovation and authorizing the project team to proceed with construction. Next slide. Thank you for your time, and that's all I've got, so we'll open things up for questions and discussion.
Thank you so much. We do have a couple of people signed up for public testimony on this item, so again, if you guys just want to take a seat right behind you, and then we'll call you back up for questions.
We have Charles Johnson and Lightning.
Good morning again. I'm Bridge Crane Charles Simpkins Johnson, and at least this facility is next to Fred Meyer that's not going to have to close. While we're looking at this little bit over $1 million project, I feel like we'd be not doing our best if there isn't some injection of just general mention about juvenile detainee health. And also the numbers. I don't remember if the average overnight stay there is less than 100, capacity there is staying under 100 or not. It's hard enough to get information about the main jail. I haven't found a dashboard for the jail. I do know that in the last 7 days, there have been about 420 releases from the jail. And so later on, when we talk about adult detention and moving 420 people a week through the jail, how much safety that really gets us. But, you know, definitely the families and friends of people who are associated with young people who are having to spend some time out there around 69th, 68th, whatever it is, deserve to have a functional and safe lobby. So investing $1 million in that makes sense, especially if we know that while those youth are there, they have an opportunity to volunteer with medical, to get a full blood screen, to be connected with a primary care provider. I'll probably have to give the speech again some week when Mr. Bravo from the health department is here, so we can make sure that there's great overlap between correctional health services and what the juveniles are receiving while they're there behind the new $1 million lobby. But it is good for their friends and family sake to come and visit them, to have a safe, efficient flow, and especially maximum connection with services. And also, some people aren't going to get any visitors. So I hope that some of you will think about that kind of intersectionality with the Behavioral Health Division and the medical services there, to make sure that if you have somebody on the books who during their entire stay at, I think it's the Donald D. Long Juvenile Detention Center, I think is the name, that when we see a young person is in custody and has no family friend visitation, somebody from mental health and health services better get on a weekly schedule with that person, please. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes, my name is Lightning. I represent Lightning Superhumanity X. One of the concerns I had on the functional safe lobby is that were there reports on some serious issues that took place in this lobby? And again, was that provided to the public for their review? Because obviously they're funding this. And that report where when you first came in and you said that there's a serious problem here and you brought someone in to assess that, was that report provided to the public? That is my question, because I would like to have a copy of that report for my review. And I'm sure there's some members of the public that would want to review that also. As you know, in Multnomah County, this property here, when you walk into the lobby as the public, you're allowed to go on the first floor. But as the public, you cannot go up on the second floor, the third floor, the fourth floor. My question is, who makes those determinations? And does the public have any say on that? And it's the same thing I'm looking at this. When I look at the picture of that lobby, it looks like a nice, safe, functional lobby in its current state. That's my opinion. Now, you might need to add maybe a few more security people at the front door, and I understand that. We're in different times, okay? But is the lobby itself, is it necessary to come in and do a whole new lobby? That's my point. And it's the same thing when we're talking the Multnomah County building here that we're currently in. I cannot walk up to the second floor. Yet we the people, we the public, finance this building. It's our building. But somebody has made the determination that we, the public, are such a risk to walk in our own building to go up on the second, third, and fourth floors. Somebody did that. You're a risk. And would the public even be able to see those reports and know who made that assessment? And it's the same thing I'm talking here. Did the public see the report, or did whoever made this assessment said that due to the potential risk to this property, we cannot provide anything to the public for their review? Because normally that's the position you'll take. So again, I do have some concerns on this. Did the public receive all the necessary information to make a reasonable determination to vote yes on this? I have not, so I vote no.
Thank you. All right, I will ask our speakers to come back up, and then we will go to the board for questions. We'll start with Commissioner Brim Edwards.
Morning, thank you for bringing this forward. I don't have any questions. I do appreciate the ongoing reassessment of all of our facilities in terms of both staff and public safety. So I'm very supportive of the changes, and thank you for bringing them forward.
Thank you. Commissioner Jones-Dixon.
Great, thank you. Thank you, Chair. And to just respond to Mr. Lightning and the APR, it does show that there was a presentation or there was an assessment in 2022, and we can share that with you. I don't have any additional questions, but thank you for the presentation.
Thank you. Commissioner Moyer.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, as we make this investment, the future of Donald Lee Long, being that such a significant portion of the building is no longer used, what our thoughts are related to that building and and its future uses, and you know, is it really the most sustainable building if we're going to continue to have a much smaller juvenile population? So, I'm sorry, can you repeat your question again? Sorry.
Yeah, and I think we have Dan. I don't know if Dan or Denise, if either of you want to address that. That's kind of a bigger picture question that I think is more appropriate for you.
Hi, good morning. Denise Pena, I use she, her pronouns. I am the director of the Department of Community Justice. That is an excellent question, Commissioner Moyer, and one that definitely we have been contemplating as we have seen capacity go down, and that is good news for the juveniles in our community. And so we have not yet had a chance to have kind of the long-term conversations about what that would look like, knowing that when this building was created, I believe in the 90s, built in the 90s, maybe not created.
Brexit.
The shift has definitely changes on how we treat those juveniles involved in our system. But you are correct. We do have several of the pods that are currently not being utilized at all in terms of housing youth. We use them for training facilities for some of our staff, and we've been able to repurpose them for others.
Good morning, Chair and Commissioners. Dan Zalko, Director of Facilities and Property Management. I'll just add that we have considered options for use of some of the vacant pods, but we've continuously run into the challenge of the unique nature of the security in the facility, in that it's not suitable for most uses by others, other departments and other organizations. There's been some storage ideas, but other than that, it's got limited use outside of the Juvenile Services Division.
All right, thank you for that. I just had a question about the lobby design, like a very small question. On slide, okay, maybe I lost the numbers. On slide 9, looks like there's an info kiosk in the library or in the lobby. And then on slide 10, it looks more like a workstation? And you said the reception area is actually behind the door. So what is the like the nature of that info kiosk?
Sure. Sorry for the inconsistency there. So the previous slide was the intent was to show the traffic flow mostly. It's from early part of the design where we hadn't established a four-person meeting room being there yet.
Okay.
So
okay.
We replaced that idea with the private meeting room space to allow a space for sensitive conversations to take place.
Great. Thank you. And I saw the there was a bullet point, I think, about the private conversation. So thank you for clarifying that for me.
Yeah, no problem.
Just appreciate all the work that has gone into this project. I know that it is, it has been several years as we've been doing the planning and the design, so it's great to see it at this stage. I appreciate all the work that DCJ and the facilities teams have done to really figure out how we can transform these spaces of justice. I think we have the new courthouse building, I think, is a really excellent example of how we can use design to really make these places of justice, you know, more appealing and more opening to the folks who are going to be using those spaces, and providing the safe and trauma informed design principles and consideration is such an important thing. So I really appreciate all the work that you have done in that. And I'm really hopeful that that thoughtfulness and intention behind it is going to resonate with the youth and the folks and the staff and the public who are using these spaces. So thank you so much for all of this. And we will go ahead and move on to, oh, you had a follow-up question?
Sure. Yeah, just based on.
Oh, sure. Go ahead.
One of the things you mentioned, because you mentioned the courthouse, and I know one of the things that came out of it is it's a more secure environment. However, it also takes more people to staff. And I'm just to staff it safely. And I'm curious whether that was looked at, whether it's much smaller than the courthouse, but whether this has an impact on staffing.
Yeah, the reorganization of the space is actually not going to require any additional staff. We were hoping it actually reduced staff, but after MCSO input, it was determined that the same two FSO officers would be required.
So MCSO has been consulted and sort of, okay.
Yeah, they've worked with us throughout the design.
And I would just add that we have modified our staffing levels because we're not going to need as many staff as we had previously with the new design.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, great. Any other follow-ups? Okay, thank you. Marina, can we have a roll call vote?
Commissioner Moyer?
Yes.
Commissioner Brim Edwards?
Yes.
Commissioner Jones-Dixon?
Yes.
Chair Vega Peterson?
Yes, the resolution is adopted.
R3, public hearing and resolution establishing fees for building permits, electrical permits, plumbing permits, mechanical permits, and other related permits pursuant to Chapter 29 of the Multnomah County Code and repealing resolution number 2024-071.
May I have a motion on all things permits?
So moved.
Second. Commissioner Jones-Dixon moves. Commissioner Moyer seconds. Approval of R3. Good morning. Hello, Kevin.
Good morning, Chair, and good morning, Commissioners. For the record, I'm Kevin Cook, Principal Planner. DCS. I think I lost my mic. Principal Planner with DCS. I'm joined with by Planning Director Megan Gibb. Also online, we have Elshad Hajiyev and Kyle O'Brien from the City of Portland. Bureau of Development Services. So today is a hearing establishing building fees, building permit fees for the county. So the City of Portland manages building regulations and permitting for the unincorporated areas of West Multnomah County, as well as urban pockets administered by the City of Portland for planning services. So those areas are otherwise known as the Portland Urban Services area. The city maintains fees for those services, which the county then sets by resolution. Most fees within the Portland permit service area are increasing by approximately 5% to help Portland permitting and development cover its operating costs. The city strives to maintain 100% fee recovery for these services, and the proposed resolution before you represents the city's fiscal year 26 fees for building permit services, electrical, mechanical, plumbing, and sanitation permits. There's also a couple of maps in your packet just showing these areas that I mentioned for coverage. And then really with that said, again, this resolution before you, city permit fees for administering the county's permitting. And Elshad and Kyle are also online if you have any questions for the city. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much. And we do have one person signed up for public testimony, so we will go ahead and do that, and then we will bring you back for any questions.
Charles Johnson.
Bridge Crane, Charles Simca Johnson again. And of course, we know that in some circles, especially around DC and any Trump facility, equity is a dirty word, but we still believe in it here. So I know mostly this is always just a matching with the city, but two things that I think we should keep in mind is do permit fees have a consistent hardship provision? I believe that even though we want bureaus and departments to be generally self-funding, I don't think we want to go to the position of saying to a low-income homeowner, single homeowner, that they always have to pay the same type of fee that would apply in a more affluent house. And that actually makes me wonder now if the fees are ever linked to the value of the project. You know, certainly I would be disappointed in us if two rooms worth of remodeling on a $400,000 house, if there's any of them left, is the same as two rooms worth of remodeling on a $2 million house. So we're probably not gonna have a space for that specific of a discussion. And I know in the past, many of you have spoken up to make sure that low-income homeowners can do what they need to do. But I definitely want that to be on the record. And if it comes into any future conversation, great. Thanks.
Great. Thank you. All right. We'll go to the board for questions. And we will start with Commissioner Jones-Dixon.
Yeah, great. Thank you. I just have one question, and I'm not sure if this even applies. So the city of Portland, they just put forth an initiative to take away SDC fees. How does that impact this? Or does it impact this at all?
I'll let the city of Portland go ahead and take this one. Yep.
Yep. Thank you, Kevin. It's great to jump on you there. But this is Kyle O'Brien. I'm the finance manager for Portland Permitting and Development at the city of Portland. The STC issue doesn't impact these fees. These are specifically for permitting, while the STCs are for public infrastructure investment. And so those are separate charges from what you're saying today.
Thank you. I might have a follow-up.
Okay, Commissioner Moyer.
I don't have a ton of questions. I'm pretty familiar. I'm just wondering, what is the timeline right now on an average permit for review? This kind of like plumbing, mechanical, that type of permitting.
Elshad Hajiev, Deputy Director for Portland Permitting and Development. We can provide you that information. We have a lot of our performance measures actually on our website. We will be gladly can provide that information on all kinds of permits to the board.
Great, thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Brim Edwards.
No questions, it seems pretty straightforward. Just confirming that the city aims for full cost recovery for with these fees?
That's correct.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much. Appreciate the city being here. Thank you for taking time this morning to help answer some of the questions that have come up. You know, we get these, I think, every year when these changes happen. I know that the city and the county IGA to administrate these services is complex, longstanding, necessary. I know, speaking of cost recovery, we took large steps in our recent adopted budget to work the county towards a two-year goal of achieving a greater cost recovery in land use. And I know there are a lot of work underway as we're looking at a more comprehensive look for that. We're going to be ending up right now with about a 30% rate recovery of fees for services applied recovery. You know, these fees proposed by the city today get them, you know, are about 100%. So I think that this is really important that we move this forward to help with that, but also keep in mind the way that we are working and the work that's underway here at the county for ours as well. So thank you so much for that. Marina, can we have a roll call vote?
Commissioner Muir?
Aye.
Commissioner Brom Edwards?
Aye.
Commissioner Jones-Dixon?
Yes.
Chair Vega Peterson?
Aye. The resolution is adopted.
Thank you.
R4, budget modification DCHS 00126 appropriates $785,726 in health share medical 1115 waiver community capacity building funding.
May I have a motion?
Second.
Commissioner Brom Edwards moves. Commissioner Moyer seconds. Approval of R4. Good morning. Thank you so much for being here, DCHS.
Good morning, Chair, Commissioners. My name is Rachel Pearl. I use she, her pronouns. I am the Deputy Director for Department of County Human Services. I'm really here to support Miles in this budget modification. I have been involved in the Medicaid 1115 housing waiver from the beginning, and Miles joined us in January and has been doing an absolutely phenomenal job of removing barriers to access for community members who are eligible for this waiver. So I'll let Miles walk you through the budmon, and we're here for questions.
Great. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm Miles Sled. I use he, they pronouns. I'm the quality manager for the Medicaid Waiver Rent Assistance Program located in YFS. This budget modification that DCHS is presenting today will allow the county to continue the work of supporting the implementation improvements related to the Medicaid 1115 demonstration waiver for housing. HealthShare of Oregon awarded Multnomah County DCHS an additional $1.3 million over 18 months to fund personnel to provide rent and utility assistance for up to 6 months per eligible household. This budget modification is for the portion of the grant to be spent in fiscal year 2026. $785,726 of this award will be spent in the current fiscal year, and the remainder will be added to the budget for fiscal year 2027. These funds allow for three new positions while also extending six previously funded positions. The overall goal of the waiver is to improve health outcomes for low-income Oregonians and eliminate health inequities. DCHS is supporting the coordinated care organizations in the implementation process and assisting in creative ways to remove the barriers so that Multnomah County residents who are eligible can access the waiver and this rent assistance funding. This funding will allow DCHS to leverage external funding to directly serve our most vulnerable populations and maintain valuable expertise within the county.
Am I first? Let me check. Do we have any public testimony on this item?
Yes, Charles Johnson.
That's okay. All right. Well, we'll call you back in just a second. Thank you. I appreciate that. I'll go to you first.
Charles Bridgecrane Simca Johnson, and it's great to by the way this was introduced, talking about workforce peer support, one person on the team supporting another. And of course, that goes deep. It goes three rows back because the department director is also here in support of her.
You hit the button on the mic.
It's such a sensitive little thing. You know, the tragedy is that we're probably after this little, not little, 1.3 million, which I guess apportioned out comes to almost 750,000 for the particular period.
it's questionable whether we'll be able to channel any more money into this program, but I still feel that we're dropping the ball and underserving our neighbors when we don't more closely pair the discussion of homelessness and eviction. We seem very reluctant to have a dashboard that says, oh, we have a homelessness problem, but we have not moved the needle on eviction, have we? I don't, nobody says saying bad things about me, so I'm like, unfortunately, I don't believe you can say you've moved the needle on eviction. And some of those people, of course, are facing eviction because of health problems. Now, hopefully, these positions that we're funding mean that there's a good communication process between people who are in eviction court while they're having a health crisis and this six-month lifeline program. Sometimes miracles happen, so maybe there's a way to grow this program through OHA or somebody and keep families in medical crisis housed with more money like this. But obviously, it's a no-brainer to take the money and get this keep this program going and look for opportunities to grow and increase efficiency. One of my volunteer jobs, of course, is to talk about efficiency. So I'm always advocating that we look harshly at balancing the staffing level with the actual number of people served. And I know you also all take your fiduciary responsibilities seriously so often that I rarely have a chance to critique you. Thank you.
Great, thank you. We'll bring you DCHS back up here and we'll go to the commissioners for questions, starting with Commissioner Moyer.
Thanks. I have some questions related to OHA and the implementation of this. I recently read an article, I think it was in the Oregonian, related to payment delays. Does OHA or the CCO directly pay the landlord, or does that come through us? It does. Can you kind of give me a quick, like, this is how it functionally works?
Sure. So one way to think about this benefit is that it's very much like receiving a prior authorization for an MRI or a complex surgery. So the Coordinated Care Organization's utilization management team is responsible to make sure that somebody meets clinical risk criteria to access the funding. And once they've authorized that, they then partner with providers. In this case, DCHS and my department is acting as a provider to be able to gather the necessary documentation from landlords, W-9s, and rent ledgers to be able to cut the checks. So the county is a provider in this situation, just like an MRI provider would be the provider.
And what are qualifying conditions that would allow somebody to have access to this?
There's a broad crosswalk of over 300 different conditions, including serious medical conditions, behavioral health conditions, social conditions. Domestic violence is an indicator. Adults who are age 65 and older will qualify. Households with children age 6 and under will qualify. It's a very broad set of conditions that's really intended to better understand the relationship between housing stability and overall healthcare spending. That's the underlying point of the 1115 waiver that funds this experiment.
Okay, this is a super in the weeds question, so if you don't know it, it's totally fine to come back. Can we use this housing benefit in our 1115 waiver to cover the client portion of housing in a long-term care setting if they are hospitalized in order to not lose the long-term care setting, like an adult foster home, a supported housing, that type of a?
Yeah, very clearly, yes. As long as the person is not in that facility using a Section 8 voucher, then very clearly, yes, that's inbounds for this kind of funding.
And what is what has our experience been with rolling this out and our ability to enroll people and also the timeliness of payment?
So we have really focused on working with households that have been authorized for the benefit. There are around 2,000 households in Multnomah County that have received an authorization and are waiting for a payer provider. So we're trying to work with the folks that have already gotten a yes and are waiting for somebody to help make rent and utilities assistance possible. I would say that part of what we have learned thus far is that providing utilities assistance is complicated. The Medicaid rules in particular add some additional complication. We're working on automating as much as we can of our processes so that we're able to serve more households on a monthly basis.
Great, thank you. Thank you so much. I appreciate the work that you all have been in leading this and trying to, and working with OHA to see how can we make this 1115 waiver actually functionable for our community and get these dollars out the door in the most efficient way. So again, I just really appreciate the way that you guys have stepped into this space and are doing that. You know, this is going to allow us to continue to support that work of the implementation, which we know is desperately needed to help with the eviction prevention, especially as we're seeing funding for other parts of our homelessness system go away, either because of changing revenue forecasts or less money from the legislature. So this is a really important piece of that puzzle and a really critical way of making sure we're not having more families and people enter homelessness. So thank you so much for all of your work for this. I will go ahead and ask for a roll call vote. I was on a roll. Okay, please, my colleagues. We haven't had these meetings in a while.
I'm just going to say, on issues like this, I'm always appreciative when Commissioner Moyer is the lead-off batter.
Yeah.
All right. I don't have any additional questions.
Commissioner Jones, extend your...
But I like to be asked, nevertheless.
I know, of course. It was just rusty skills we haven't met. All right, thank you so much. Okay, now we can have a vote, now that everyone has had the chance to.
Commissioner Moyer?
Aye.
Commissioner Brim Edwards? Aye. Commissioner Jones Dixon?
Yes.
Chair Vega Peterson?
Yes, the budget modification is approved. All right, thank you so much, DCHS. I'm glad nobody voted no just in protest of not getting a chance to speak. Now is when we have time for board comments on non-agenda items, and I will open it up to commissioners to see who has anything to discuss today.
We had a great experience at the NACO conference, so just want to thank the county for that and the organizers of the conference. And then yesterday, the Deep War Office, we hosted our second conversation around just homeless services out in East Multnomah County. We received a ton of feedback, and we look forward to bringing that feedback to the board come September. So that's it. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Commissioner Brim Edwards?
So two things. One, I look forward to Pride this weekend. I do think there will be a full contingency from the county, and I look forward to joining with county colleagues in repping for the county. Second, on July 2nd, there was a fatal shooting downtown midday that allegedly started as an argument on the steps of the Central Library. Soon after that, I had conversations with the sheriff, Chief Day, Multnomah County Security Chief, the DA, the mayor and the chair's office, as well as informally with library staff. And while I want to respect that this is in Commissioner Moyer's district, the Central Library is kind of our crown jewel of the library system. But it also, I don't think, is just an issue, public safety around our libraries, just confined to the Central Library. Our libraries are well-loved and well-used, and we want all our county residents to feel that they can either go to their neighborhood branch or go downtown to the Central Library. And when violence either begins or happens within our public spaces, I think it's really important that we look at what changes need to be made to ensure that we have a safe environment, not just for community users of the library, but also for our staff. And I understand from my conversations with public safety leaders and city and county leaders that there are ongoing discussions, requests have been made, of the county to the city to the county, just given sort of the jurisdictional coordination that's needed. And while I've received a fair number of reports that incident, and I'm very much appreciative of it, I would like to request that we have something public-facing on what steps the city and county are taking in a coordinated action to improve community safety, both inside and immediately adjacent to our libraries. And again, this isn't just the central library, but our public spaces and our libraries, which we want the community to continue to feel safe using and accessible. They're just critical places for many of our community members. And we certainly want our staff to feel safe in their work environment as well. So I hope that we can, either through an agenda or some sort of report to the commission, so that we can share and I think reassure our community that our libraries are places that are you should continue using and loving as they currently do.
Yes, thank you. Commissioner Moore, do you have any comments?
Yeah, I want to acknowledge some attention that we are getting, I'm not really sure why, from the Department of Homeland Security and their interest in focusing on Portland and I would assume the metropolitan region. And, you know, I have the ICE detention facility in my district. I have gone by regularly to check on the situation so that I am unbiased in my understanding of what is occurring. And I have become very concerned by the nature of the chemical deterrents that are being used so close to a preschool. Where canisters of various pepper sprays and other, I'm not an expert on these chemical deterrents, are ending up in the playground. So I wish to express my concern and to look at the degree to which these type of chemicals harm children or others, and what our role as the public health authority is. I don't know if we have jurisdiction over the actions of a federal law enforcement, but I do have concerns that is a residential area, as well as having a school right next to it. And I just want to make sure that people's right to peacefully protest is respected, and that if any crowd control is necessary, that it be done in a way as to not cause a type of harm that is unacceptable in our community.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate all the comments today. I will say it was a pleasure to go to the NACO conference. And I think one of the things that really struck me as the voting delegate for Multnomah County was the fact that at the NACO level, they vote based on the population of the counties, where when we participate in the Association of Oregon Counties, that is not the case. It is by the number of commissioners who are showing up from counties regardless. And that makes a significant difference, I think, in some of the outcomes. So that is something that I want us, as we're engaging in AOC, to continue to move forward. I will say that they just, you know, remind folks like the dues for AOC are based on population, however, so we pay the most dues for that organization. It was really great to connect with county officials from across the country, from the large urban county caucus, from other county executives. Those are some of the things that are most valuable to me, and just really appreciate the board participating as much as we were able to this time around. I wanted to say thank you for the folks who have been engaging with the hot weather this week. That is something that, you know, we have been keeping a very close eye on every morning for the last several days, leadership from across the county, from different cities, from my office, Health Department, Emergency Management, Homeless Services Department, Communications, County Human Services, have met with our partners at the cities and beyond to assess the risks that this heat wave poses on the community. It was good that we didn't get severe conditions that were high enough to meet thresholds for opening cooling centers. We also didn't see an increase in emergency room visits that we've seen in other hot weather incidents. But despite that, there was a lot of work that has been happening. And so I want to express my appreciation for everybody who's been involved behind the scenes in the planning and monitoring of the conditions. There are several people who have worked throughout the period of heat to provide enhanced outreach and cooling materials distribution to the community. We had folks at our library staff who worked extended hours to ensure our vulnerable community members had some relief from the heat. The city had, you know, so many splash pads and misting stations open that were very helpful for the community. So I just want to really appreciate all of the county employees who took up the call to support the county's severe weather response. We had several people take the severe weather training this week, which is always great, and I encourage folks to do that. You know, being able to be ready, to be trained, so that we can step up and quickly serve the community is incredibly important. And it was inspiring to see how many people took up that call to do that. I also want to appreciate the gratitude all the folks at the Central Library, the security staff, library leadership, our employees, our contractors at Intercom Security for keeping patrons safe during the tragic shooting that happened across the street from the library earlier this month on July 1st. You know, we have had conversations as a board of commissioners, as an organization for the past few years about library security and the balance between access to the public for one of the few spaces where everyone in the public is able to attend, and how do we continue to make that accessible to all people. And so that is a conversation that is ongoing. I want to appreciate the leadership of Annie Lewis, who is really stepping into the space and really thinking really deeply, engaging with her peers across the country, and also thinking how, you know, the big differences and things that are gonna, that we need to do that might look and feel different to people who are normally accessing our libraries, but that our situation calls for. So we're gonna continue to move forward with that work. I'm happy. I know that the information has been shared with the board. We can talk about that. There's been an after action report already on the incident specifically and more work that's happening. So I will make sure that we are able to share that information publicly. We did have the library closed for a period of time, and we want to make sure that we're continuing to support our library staff and our employees during this period. And so that will continue to be a very important part of that conversation as well. I want to make it clear to the community that we are doing everything that we can for patrons to feel safe and comfortable when visiting our libraries. It is very important that we're working closely with our partners at the city to ensure the safety of the area around the library, that where it is outside, you know, the county property, but there are incidents that need a different kind of response, a response outside the authority of the county and the library. And so we are going to continue to have those conversations as well. And then finally, I will just say that we are all looking forward to Pride this weekend. And I want to thank again so many of our employees who have been putting together our Multnomah County float. I will say it again, we are 12th in line for that. So that is a really great place to be. So want to welcome everyone to join and march with your county colleagues to the parade. It is optional, it's on a voluntary basis, but there is an interest form that was sent out in the yesterday's Wednesday wire that people can use to sign up. We have about 200 slots for marchers, and we are going to strive to ensure that there is an equitable distribution of representation from across the county. We really want to see that. We also want to make sure that we are prioritizing members of PRISM and QDPOC employee resource groups so that they are able to represent. So want to thank, again, the Board of Commissioners and the Health Department for sponsoring this and making this possible. With that, there being no further business, our next...
Commissioner Brim, are we able to do a formal briefing, an update regarding...
We'll talk with leadership and library leadership about the best time to do that. But yeah, that's something that we can be working on for sure. Thank you. So there being no further business, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.